Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. wandaspicks.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspicks.asmnnetwork.org. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. This morning we are going to be hearing from two wonderful musicians, Karen Allison, who's going to be coming to San Francisco next week, August 31st through September 2nd at the Raz Room, premiering her latest, Round Midnight, and that's going to be really wonderful. And we're going to get her in the studio in a little bit. And then we're going to be talking to Muziki Roberson, who is going to be performing at Yoshi's on Monday, the 27th, yeah, in Oakland, and he's going to be bringing his string orchestra. And we last saw Muziki with Michael White at the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival this summer, and that was just spectacular. Muziki on piano, Cash Killian on cello and other instruments, and Michael White on violin with his lovely wife. It was just fantastic. Jerika Lewis, Sandy Poindexter, and a lot of other great folks on stage. It was just phenomenal, so you don't want to miss that. And then we're going to be talking to Denny Zulu, Gene Tini, out of Florida. He's going to be talking about the commemoration that they're going to be doing for our ancestors in honor of UNESCO's declaration of a commemoration that was on the 23rd, which was yesterday, of honoring the abolition of the legal importation of people of African descent and the end of slavery. So that's going to be, we're going to be having him on. And then we're going to close out with an interview with a new director who has a film, new director Derek Ting, and he's also the writer of this financial thriller, Wall Street Meets Asia, filmed in both New York and Hong Kong. It's called Super Capitalist, and that's going to be opening at Landmark Theaters in Northern California today, August 24th. So you can get over there to the Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, and he is actually going to be in, he actually is in town. We talked to him while he was on the road, and he's going to be joining he's going to be joined by one of the key protagonists. We could almost call her his conscience. Is going to be traveling. Actually, is here as well, and she's going to be performing as well. Her name is Kathy Ewan, and so it should be really nice. So we're going to play one of Karen Allison's pieces from Round Midnight while we try to get her in the studio. We're going to play, I think about maybe playing a title track, but maybe we'll save that one. So I'm going to play another one that I like of hers. I like the title. Spring Can Really Hang You Up.
I was a sentimental thing. Threw my heart away each spring. Now a spring romance. stand a chance. Promised my last dance to winter. And all I've got to show is a splinter. Spring this year has got me feeling like a horse that never left the post. I lie in my room, staring up at the ceiling. Spring can't really hang you up. Morning's kiss brings trees and flowers, and to them I'd like to pose a toast. I walk in the park just to kill the lonely hours. Spring can't really hang you up the most. All afternoon the birds twitter twist. I know the tune. This is love, this is it. I heard it before, and I know decided that spring is a bore. Love came sure around the new year. Now it's April. Love is just a ghost. Spring arrived on. Only what became of you, dear? Spring can't really hang you up the most. Spring can really hang you up the most. Love came my way. Doctors once prescribed a tonic, sulfur and molasses was the dose. That didn't help one bit. My condition must be chronic. Spring can really hang you up the most. I'm all alone. The party's over. Old man Winter was a gracious host.
Karen Allison singing Spring Can Really Hang You Up. And gosh, I'm having some difficulty getting her on in the studio. So I hope we're going to be able to do this today, because I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to play another cut from that latest, which is really, really amazing. Karen plays all the keyboard parts, piano and Rhodes, on this particular album, and that's the first time in 13 records. Isn't that amazing that she's doing so? And she says she's returning to her roots. So, it's going to really be phenomenal, this show that's coming up. So let's play another one of her pieces. We will play Send in the Clown.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clown. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clouds. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours. Making my hands once again with my usual flair, sure of my lines, no one there. Don't you love my fall? I fear I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear. Where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother. Thank you.
Goodness, I'm getting worried. Okay, so we're gonna play one more song, and then I might actually be giving up. We're gonna play "I'm Always Chasing Rainbows" for Oludamare. Okay, so this is gonna work, right? Next time you hear from me, we're gonna have this artist in the studio. Okay. "I'm Always Chasing Rainbows." I think this is such a lovely piece. Isn't this a great, great album? I mean, even without her presence, we have her presence. It's just really beautiful, "Round Midnight." And it was nominated for the 2012 Grammy Best Jazz Vocal Album. And this woman has been nominated for Grammys and has gotten Grammys a lot of times. So anyway, so here's another one.
Chasing rainbows, watching clouds drifting by. My schemes are just like all my dreams, ending in the sky. Thank you.
Well, I guess I'm not going to be able to keep my promise because I don't think we're going to get Miss Allison in the studio. Maybe we can still get her before the 31st rolls around. But anyway, I just want to let you know a little bit about her. We already talked about this 13 albums, and she writes in her on her on her website, Karen.com, that she's shouting about that. And she lives in New York City now, but she grew up in, she had a childhood in the Midwest and schooling in the Bay Area, right? She has a degree in classical piano performance and important stints in Minneapolis and Kansas City, where she began her recording career with Concord Jazz. She currently spends 2 days out of three on tour playing the major jazz festivals, concert venues, and clubs for the United States, and making repeated tours overseas to Brazil, Japan, Australia, and the great cities of Europe. Among musicians, she's known as the great band leader, and one of the great pleasures of the current scene is listening to her highly developed interplay with her bandmates. It sounds so effortless, but it conceals the deep musical sophistication that she embodies. This is one of Allison's great achievements, the result of working for more than a decade with an ensemble of fearless and powerfully committed jazz virtuosos. We would just love to have had her on the air, and don't know what's going on with regards to these glitches, but we're going to play the title track and then get Muziki Roberson in the studio because I know I can get him. All righty. Got a chance to go by his studio, really fabulous studio, and he said that the rehearsal is going well with his band and it's going to just be phenomenal. And we're so happy that he can get up this early in the morning to talk to us because he says no one else would even think about it. I'm just kidding. So here's Allison's title track, Round Midnight.
It begins to tell round midnight, round midnight. I do pretty well till after sundown. Supper time, I'm feeling sad, but it really gets bad around midnight. Memories always start round midnight. Haven't got the heart to stand those memories. When my heart is still with you, and old midnight knows. When some quarrel we've had needs mending, does it mean that our love is ending? Darling, I need you. Lately I find you're out of my. The angels sing for your eternity. Let our love be safe and sound when old midnight rolls around. Does it mean that our love is ending? Darling, I need you, but lately I find you're out of my arms and I'm out of my mind. Let our love take wing round midnight, let the angels sing for your returning. Let our love be safe and let our love be sound when old midnight, when it rolls.
Midnight, title track for Karen Allison's latest release, and we weren't able to get her in the studio this morning, but we certainly had her in the studio, if you know what I mean, because this new contribution to the legacy of this genre, which is known as jazz or creative music, America's only original music, is certainly phenomenal, and we want to thank her for this wonderful contribution. So I'm going to play a little bit of Musiki Roberson, and then we're going to get him in the studio and talk about this great concert that's coming up here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and a couple of other announcements I want to let you know about. We had April on, and she was talking about her double feature tonight at the Humanist Hall, Mama Jugs, in the evening of theater, being performed with her latest piece, The Men in Me. So that should be really, really great, and we'll give you more information about that. We had her on the air on Wednesday. She was our closing interview. And we also have this weekend at the African American Museum and Library, we're going to be having a really wonderful reception, artist reception, for The Way of the Doll. It's going to really be phenomenal. This exhibit opened in June, and it's going through November 10th. But this, you'll be able to meet the dolls. Creators, beat the artists. So that's going to really be great. And African American Museum and Library, or AMLO, is located at 659 14th Street in Oakland. And there's going to be another mini doll workshop, if you missed the one last week, August 11th. It's going to be on September 8th, and there's no age limit. Starting at 7 years old, adults and children can learn, get their doll making on, and that's going to be from 1 to 3. And if you want to register for the doll making workshop, you should call 510-272-9453, 272-9453-510 area code. And you can also visit American Black Beauty Dolls, American Black Beauty Doll Artists, singular, doll.com for all the information. So let's play a piece by Musiki Roberson, his title track on the album Stealth Jazz. I really like that title, Stealth Jazz. We have to ask him about that. And this first one is called Seance. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, S-E-A-N-C-E. So we have to ask him how to say it too. So here we are. Thank you. Mikey Roberson on piano, and he is in the studio, like I promised. Like, we really do have him. We conjured him up. Seance. So tell us about seance.
Seance. Well, you know, it's a tune I wrote a long time ago, and seance is a conjuring up of the spirits, and so that's what it's about. Dave Ellis on it, and Troy Lampkins, and Steve Rossi on drums. Yeah, that's, this record is like, I did it in the 90s, late 90s, 99, I think. But, you know, I want to talk about the new stuff. You there?
Yeah. I'm waiting for my daughter to open the door so we don't hear my alarm system, but I think we heard a little bit of it, but that's okay. Yeah, let's talk about the new stuff. I mentioned to our audience that if they were at the Malcolm Jazz Arts Festival this summer, that they were able to see you on stage. And then the next day, you know, there was an intimate concert, you with Michael White, renowned violinist, and you said you were inspired by, you know, the All Strings concert to have your own.
Yeah, I got really, I got a thing for the strings now. I got sprung.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really nice. I had a couple more strings.
Mm-hmm.
I had four violins and cello at the Malcolm X Festival.
Right, yeah.
So, but I had to scale it down a little bit, so I just have the three beautiful ladies playing with me, Tarika Lewis, India Cook, and Sandy Poindexter.
Wow, creme de la creme.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah, wow. You know, a couple of them used to play with John Handy in class, and they're all very, very good musicians. They're very accomplished, and it's a pleasure to be working with them.
Yeah, so what you all going to have, what you going to be doing with the Musiki Roberson Ensemble on Monday?
Well, we're going to be doing all original stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. Well, when I have gigs, that's what I do.
Oh, okay.
I don't ever play anybody's. Although I'm doing one tune that Mark Wright wrote, but I arranged. and I'm going to have him sit in as a guest artist on the gig.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we play every Tuesday night in the Grassroots Composers Ensemble here at my house.
Oh, so that's where it moved, because I really
like
it.
Well, we were playing the first Fridays at Eastside Arts Alliance, first Friday of every month for a while,
mm-hmm.
almost a year, actually.
Right.
And we'll probably resume that eventually.
Mm-hmm.
We had to take a little sabbatical from it, you know. But that's a group that's, It's like a workshop kind of where people work on their arranging skills. It's five horns and rhythm section.
Yeah. We had some of you all on to talk about the Grassroots Ensemble when you all kicked it off.
Yeah.
So is this Tuesday evening concert, is that open?
Oh, it's not a concert.
Oh, it's a jam session? What is it?
No, it's not a jam session. It's a workshop. We've been doing it for about seven, 8 years now.
Oh,
every
so you...
Tuesday night.
Okay.
Mostly every Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. Every now and then we have to cancel for one reason or another, but mm-hmm. generally on Tuesdays we're all here.
Okay. And so that's the workshop is sort of where the ensemble.
Well,
we
work out our arrangements,
okay.
you know, for the five horns. And for a long time, we weren't gigging. We had a gig at Anna's Jazz Island back in the day when she was still open. And then we started doing the first Fridays at Eastside.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped in December. And we'll probably resume pretty soon. And you know, it's a lot of original materials. Mac Rux and Mark Wright and myself do the bulk of the composing and arranging, and Joe McKinley on bass. He added some contributions also. So yes, it's great, a great learning experience, you know, and it's nice to be able to hear your ideas come into fruition. Mm-hmm. You know.
Right. Yeah. You played all over the place, and
I've been very blessed in my career. You know, I traveled for 12 years with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And we went everywhere, you know, all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of places, not all over the world, but we went to East Berlin before the wall came down and traveled all over Europe. And we went to Nicaragua and Israel and Mexico, Canada, all over the United States, little obscure towns that I didn't even know existed until I went there. Like McMinnville, Oregon, for instance.
Where's that?
That's in Oregon.
Yeah, I know it's in Oregon.
it's kind of between Eugene and Portland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And don't you hail from the Pacific Northwest?
I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Seattle. I lived in Seattle from the sixth grade through high school.
Yeah.
And then I went in the Army, and that's where I got interested in music. I met some guys that were in the Army band. Michael Carvin, the drummer who lives in New Jersey now. But he was instrumental in me getting an interest in music.
Right.
And when I got back from Vietnam, I went to school on a GI Bill and studied theory and orchestration and stuff.
Where did you go to school to study music?
I went to Lone Mountain College.
Okay.
I went to City College for a year, and then I transferred to Lone Mountain.
Yeah, USF.
Yeah, it's USF now. Back then it was Lone Mountain College.
Yeah, the Lone Mountain.
But it's now the Lone Mountain campus of USF, I guess.
Right, yeah. I that's where I studied.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah, for my master's in writing. I hear that used to be like the place where the sisters had their convents or something like that.
Yeah, I know for a while it was an all-woman school. And then it was co-ed for a while.
Yeah.
Until it got taken over by USF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Muziki means music. Isn't that amazing? So you
in Swahili, yourself?
Yes. Yeah.
When I was at City College, I took a class in Swahili.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher gave everybody names.
Ah.
And the name that he gave me was Mcheza Muziki, which loosely translates to player of music. So I dropped the Mcheza part and just, you know, I've been Muziki. I got the name in 1971.
Yeah, that's the only name that I know you by.
Yeah. Well, my birth name is Dwayne.
Right, yeah. When I see that, I always like, who is this? And I was like, oh, okay, because the other name is there somewhere. Or
so now I use Muziki Dwayne Roberson.
Yeah. For those of us that we came in on the Muziki part of your history.
Right.
Yeah. In your bio, which is on your MySpace page, you talk about some of the ensembles you perform with and some of the musicians you perform with. And I remember seeing you as a part of Mingus Among Us. Really love that group.
Yeah.
For whenever they perform. And
That was a group that I had a lot of fun with. I played with them, I don't know, like around 7 years or so. And we did a lot of traveling. Went to Cuba. Did a live CD there.
Right, I remember that. Yeah.
And we went to Europe a couple of times. You know, it was Turkey and Greece and Brussels and where else did we go? Oh, Italy.
Yeah.
So that was a fun group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I wanted to strike out on my own.
So
I've been kind of doing my thing and writing a lot of music, and I like playing my own original stuff. gigs.
So speaking of original music, so what, you know, what have you been writing for your gig on the 27th at Yoshi's in Oakland?
Well, I'm doing some things that I started writing with the Grassroots Ensemble, and some things from the past. I have this one tune, The Water Bearer, that Dave Ellis recorded on a CD,
mm-hmm.
and that a lot of people really like, so that I consider that one of my hits.
Okay.
So I did a string arrangement for that,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a bunch of tunes. I got about 6 tunes that I arranged. Including the one that Mark Wright wrote.
Right, yeah. So do you have any? Do you have any guest vocalists? Because I know on your
no.
Yes, you have a guest vocalist.
I would love to have like Scheherazade, but she's on my CD on one tune. But I don't. That's the only vocal tune that I have. Actually, the one that she sang on my CD.
Okay.
I may incorporate some vocals in the future, but right now it's just all instrumentals.
Yeah, yeah. So you were a part of the 1977 Festech.
Yeah, we were over there with Michael White. It was a wonderful experience. I got to play with Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, and he was just here 2 weeks ago.
And I got to play with OCBISA.
Ah, nice. Who's OCBISA?
OCBISA was his group from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they played, they were in the kind of Afrobeat meets Santana kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And their logo was like flying elephants.
Mm.
You know, people, you know, you might be too young to remember that group. But it was a pretty popular group back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we all joined Stevie. Stevie came over without a band. So he used Michael White's band and members of OCBISA
mm-hmm.
to accompany him. And that was a wonderful experience. We played in a stadium. It was, I don't know, 40,000 people.
Wow.
So that's probably the biggest crowd I've ever played for.
Yeah, to date, right?
Yeah.
But hey, you know, you can top that.
Well, hopefully we'll get that many at Yoshi's.
Yeah, people be standing like miles away to get in.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I've had a really, you know, I never made a whole lot of money or anything. I've done okay, but you know, I've been blessed in being able to travel and do what I love doing.
Yeah. You've you know, you mentioned that your favorite musician is Wayne Shorter.
Yeah.
But you've also, you know, I remember when late Billy Bang, wonderful violinist and musician and composer, was doing his Vietnam series. And
yeah, well, I'm a Vietnam vet also,
mm-hmm.
so that's, and Michael Carbon, who I mentioned earlier, who I met in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Kind of got me hooked up with Billy.
Right.
So I played a couple gigs out here with him,
mm-hmm.
and then he sent for me, and I played Vibes with him in New York,
mm-hmm.
and he passed not too long after that, actually.
Oh, really?
But he was a beautiful brother, a very gifted violinist, and I feel fortunate to have been able to play with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and the thing I did in Malcolm X when I got to String Summer together was a tribute to him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. His style was certainly unique, and one can.
Yeah, he was very virtuosistic.
Yeah, so Wayne Shorter, talk about that relationship.
Well, I went to a concert. I met him briefly,
mm-hmm.
and he signed my copy of his book called Footprints, and but just, you know, the scope of his music, from his Art Blakey days to his Blue Note days to Weather Report to what he's doing now, I think he's right up there in terms of being a composer with Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just admire his work a lot, you know.
Yeah. You have this wonderful studio, you know, in the heart of the community, and you're also a businessman. I mean, you actually produce, right?
I produced my CD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I you have to be kind of resourceful if you want to be just a musician and not work a 9-to-5 job. So, mm-hmm. So I have my little duplication business, and but you know I like sharing. So I have a workshop every Wednesday, and I have. Heather Watkins playing piano, and I might try to get this workshop group a gig somewhere, maybe at 57th Street Gallery. And I play vibes. I've been playing vibes for about 7 years, and I've had 3 gigs so far on vibes. I did a little vibe summit with Yancey Taylor.
Oh, really? When was that?
That was at Anna's.
Okay. Oh, nice.
And yeah, we both were playing vibes. It was fun,
uh-huh.
You know. I'm still trying to get my chops together on vibes. It's a whole different chop than piano, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's coming.
Yeah.
And I'll probably get a gig on vibes in the future and hire a good piano player like Glenn Pearson or somebody.
A good piano player. Okay.
Yeah, Glenn, he's
oh,
awesome.
Oh, Glenn is phenomenal. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, so are you, but you can't play both.
No.
Yeah, wow. So we see you with Babatunde Lee when he's in town, Ranzel Mayer.
Yeah, Babatunde
was. Up on drums. He got his own group now, and... Yeah, Dave Ellis.
Yeah, and actually, Ranzel Mayer's son, who's a young prodigy, he's really awesome. He's 19 now.
Oh, is he? Wow. Okay.
But he played a gig or two with me back
okay.
in the day when he was still, you know, like underage.
mm-hmm.
But he's really awesome, and hopefully I'll get him involved in some stuff. I think he's in back in New York. He got a scholarship to go to. School of Arts or something in
oh,
New York.
Oh, good for him. Nice.
I'm really proud of him, you know.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. Because I think when Max Roach passed, didn't he, or was it his brother that went to the funeral?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, his father was telling me about that. And, mm-hmm. you know, he went by himself and, you know, hooked up with mm-hmm. someone there to...
Yeah, I think he may have gone with Earl Davis, actually.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Nice.
Earl Davis is a good friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to Stealth Jazz. I just love the title, Stealth, you know, and Seance and Dogon Dance and Dog Star Rhapsody. It's like, ooh, what is this? Man, nice. Yeah, it's really...
Well, I've always had kind of an interest in metaphysics and...
Okay.
And I had a band called Serious Business.
Oh, wow. That's,
like Serious,
yeah.
Sirius.
Oh, yeah, totally got that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. Wow, that's great. Any of the people that we named a part of that ensemble?
No, this was when I was in the Mime Troupe.
Oh, okay.
I had the Mime Troupe band. I had Randy Marsh on drums and Dan Hart on bass. Tobaji Stewart was playing percussion, and I was playing piano. It was just a quartet.
Right, yeah. But I just know we're speaking to Muziki Roberson and his ensemble featuring strings. It's going to be performing at Yoshi's in Oakland, Jack London Square, on Monday, 8 o'clock.
Yeah, it's just one show, so if you plan on making a second set, it's not going to be a second set. Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, so, yeah, I hope to have the full house. We're going to be recording also.
Oh, lovely.
hopefully I'll be releasing a CD, you know, live at Yoshi's.
So. Well, that'll work. That'll work for their 40th anniversary. They got a jazz festival this weekend, too, a free one.
Yeah, actually, I'm playing with the Oaktown Jazz Workshop.
Oh, cool.
At that Sunday morning.
Okay, what time?
I don't know exactly what time my set is, but I have to be there at 10:30, so I imagine it's like around noonish.
Okay, Sunday morning.
And then I have my last rehearsal with the ensemble that's playing at Yoshi's Sunday afternoon, so Sunday's going to be a very musical day for me.
Yeah.
Most of my days are, though.
Yeah, you look really happy.
I am. I just completed a 10-day fast. I'm feeling lucid. And I've slimmed down.
Yeah, you were looking really good yesterday evening.
Oh, thank you.
Look at
me. Uh-oh. Yes, I feel really good, you know, physically and mentally right now.
Yeah, is this a part of your regimen when you have something special happening or just happen to fall?
No, it's just something that me and my esposa do a couple times a year.
Okay.
Just to detox and clean up, you know,
yeah.
And try to live healthy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, certainly, certainly. So this particular CD, the one that you gave me that we've been talking about, not the live at Yoshi's that's coming up, Stealth Jazz, you dedicated to your parents. Remember your parents, Samuel and Ruby Roberson.
Right.
Yeah.
They both passed within 7 months of each other. You know, I love both of them very much. You know, they were very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I thought I would dedicate it to them.
Yeah, it's really nice. So I was thinking we could close our conversation with one of your pieces. I really like, the metaphysical. That's one of my undergraduate degree is in philosophy. So I like metaphysics. My father used to read those kind of books, and I wouldn't know what he was talking about until I took philosophy in college. I was like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
All those references.
Yeah, I've always had an interest. I've read a bunch of Edgar Cayce books and the Urantia book and all kind of books. You know, I used to be kind of obsessed with it, actually. But, you know, I had to stop because there was so much information, you know. And I read this book about the Dogon tribe and how they knew about all these star systems and stuff prior to the astronomers discovering them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Sirius mystery is called. And I still have quite a library of metaphysical books, actually. And I open them up every now and then, you know, to read.
Yeah, because, metaphysics, you know, just sort of help us go deeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I have Dogon dance. Actually, when I went to Mali a couple of years ago, I wanted to go to Dogon land.
Mm-hmm.
And
Did you make it?
No.
No?
No, I couldn't find anybody to take me there.
Yeah, that's something I would love to do, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm going to get there. I just didn't get there this time. Last time. And then your title track, Stealth, it's like Stealth. Yeah, that's nice, too. So, your choice. We can do Dogon Dance, or we can do Stealth Jazz.
Well, do Dogon Dance.
Okay.
I like that one.
All right, cool, super. So you want to give folks your MySpace? It's myspace.com/ Duane, Duane Muziki, Muziki, Roberson, Roberson. That's his MySpace website. So are you kin to Paul Roberson?
No, actually, my name is Roberson. His name was Robeson.
Oh, okay. No R.
No R.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't remember that detail.
Mm.
Okay.
I get asked that a lot, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure. Yeah. Well, it's nice to call to mind, you know, Paul Robeson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great, great voice.
Yeah.
Great man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. Aziki, you want to tell us anything else that I didn't ask you about? Did I leave anything out?
Well, let's see. The lineup for my Yoshi's gig would be myself, Dave Ellis on saxophone, Pierre Archin on bass, Greg German on drums, and Sandy in India and Tarika. Sandy Poindexter, Tarika Lewis, and India Cook.
Right.
Violins.
Mm-hmm. And
so I'm really looking forward to it. They sound great. And they're all top flight musicians. So.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. And the show starts at 8. There is only one show.
Right.
So
doors open at 7.
Okay. Yeah, and it's going to be packed.
Right.
So, you know, one wants to get there. So one can get
Well, I hope it's going to be packed.
Oh, you're famous.
I don't know about all of that. But anyway. So, yeah, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, it's great talking to you. It's always great to
Gary, go out and play some tennis.
Oh, fun, fun. We'll have a good time.
Me and Dave play, Dave Ellis, we play 3 or 4 times a week.
Okay, where we're at?
In Berkeley at
okay.
San Pablo Park. They
oh,
have some
nice
courts.
Yeah, I was just there for the Eid El Fitr on Sunday.
Mm.
It is a very nice park, right
yeah.
in the community. Real beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They have 6 nice courts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's cool. Well, have fun.
All righty, thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you on Monday, if not Sunday. Congratulations. And I'm looking forward to your live at Yoshi's.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, you take good care.
You too.
Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we have Denny Zulu, Gene Cheney on the air to talk about the ritual, the commemoration that's going to be has been canceled because of some weather fronts coming in, but they're not unexpected. But I still wanted him to be on the air to talk about this commemoration because he is like my point person on these UNESCO commemorations about our ancestors. And I think, you know, the folks in Key West, I think you all must be holding it down on you know, sort of keeping our ancestors, you know, legacy and energy lifted up on a regular basis.
We're trying hard, and of course, a lot of that is really brought to us more so than us, you know, having to reach for it. Mm-hmm. In the case of Key West, as your listeners might know from some of the prior conversations, there's a cemetery there called the African Cemetery, where 295 Africans, mostly children, young people, are buried. And this was from 1860, when three American-owned slave ships were captured by the U.S. Navy and brought into Key West. There were 1,432 African captives aboard who survived out of, there were more than 1,700 who left Africa, so that gives you an idea of what the loss already was. And they were detained in Key West for 12 weeks, you know, awaiting what they call repatriation, which is actually a return to, a return to Liberia, which is not where they were originally from. But during those 12 weeks, 295 of them just died from the conditions they had suffered, and they were buried in shallow graves in Key West, right near the beach. And that story sort of lay dormant for a good while until around 1996-97. When a researcher named Gail Swanson, you know, brought up the story, and some of the local people, an activist who named Norma Jean Sawyer, you know, took an interest in that and really helped bring it to light. So what we have in Key West is a very unique landmark where Africans who were never actually sold into slavery, died and are were buried and you know that's still the final resting place, even though it itself has been disturbed many times with construction projects and so forth. So even in death, these folks have been violated. So going back to your original point, having an opportunity to just reach out to those ancestors, to all those unquiet spirits, all those who perished in the Middle Passage and those who survived to give us life, is just such an important thing for us to do. And given the opportunity to do that and given the a place like that, we really had no choice but to do that. Mm-hmm. And the occasion for, you know, this week, of course, is the International Day for the Abolition. Let's get it right. International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition was declared by the UN for August 23rd, and that date was chosen because it was the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, which was the most successful, overthrow of slavery that resulted in the establishment of an actual Black independent nation state. And so this is a global observance. It was observed yesterday in Baltimore. We were looking forward to doing it for the fourth time in Key West. We've done it down there on the Sunday closest to the date. And August 26th would have been sort of significant for the Key West story, because when those Africans who did survive were sent back to Liberia, the first ones of them arrived in Liberia on August 26th. So you see, it was significant in a number of ways. So that's kind of you know, the background of the occasion and of the story down there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are, excuse me, I'm losing my voice here. You know, in Miami, we do an annual sunrise remembrance of the Middle Passage every June, you know, closest to the summer solstice. And what we have is, you know, you sort of alluded to it, is that this whole South Florida area, and maybe just because it was closest to those, you know, routes of the slave trade, is really emerging as kind of an epicenter of, you know, awareness and interest and connections, you know, to that. And, you know, and of course, when I point that out, I always hesitate. I hasten to add that this is not to, you know, take anything away from recognizing Charleston and Sullivan's Island, where 40% of the Africans who came into this country came in. So there are places, and I don't know if anything was done or is being done in Charleston, but I would hope that, that you know, that this these observances take root there also.
Oh,
so
they do something in Charleston. In June.
Oh, good.
It's part of the international commemoration that happens on the 2nd, the international commemoration and libation for the ancestors that happens on the 2nd Saturday in June. And it's been going on for over 25 years now.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
They're close to us in Miami then, because we do ours around that third weekend in June.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought you, so I didn't have you on the air with him. you haven't been in conversation with them yet?
No, we haven't done that yet.
Oh, okay, so. Well, that was an oversight. I should have had you on the air too. Yeah, we did this big program this June. I have folks calling in who do libations for the ancestors in June in Detroit. We have folks calling in from Seattle, Charleston, New York. Yeah, British Virgin Islands.
He's done such an excellent job of pulling all these things together and being this kind of one-woman clearinghouse, you know. And, you know, now that you say it, I think it was – the intent was to try to connect those things this past June, but somehow it didn't work out. But
okay.
Yeah.
Because like I said, I think in South Florida, I think you all have the most, because I think you mentioned to me when you gave me the really nice sort of overview of, and I just love, you know, the emails that you send throughout the year about different things that you're finding out about our people, particularly our ancestors. You know, you mentioned that there are 4 dates that the UN has set aside to recognize the Black Holocaust. And I believe one is in March. They've got the one in June. And you mentioned some other dates.
Right. March 25th is the International Day for the Remembrance of the Victims of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. That's the official. Then August 23rd is the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, where we start recognizing some of the heroes, starting with the Haitian Revolution. And then December 2nd is the International Day for the Abolition of Slavery, which is still going on in, you know, many parts of the world. And it's interesting, going back to March, that the March 25th day comes right after March 21st, mm-hmm. which I guess is about the best known of those, because that's the anniversary of the Sharpeville Massacre in South Africa back in
that. Oh, wow.
And that became the International Day for the Elimination of Racism and Discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And just to show you how all of those things connect, I mean, March 21st was also the date of the Ponce Massacre in Puerto Rico, where the people were actually celebrating the anniversary of the abolition of slavery, and it got into a confrontation with police and all of that. So, you know, it's sort of strange that here in the United States there's this, there's this whole idea of the United States kind of being exempt and exceptional, and, you know, these international observances hardly ever get any kind of recognition, you know. Last year, for example, 2011 was declared, the entire year was the International Year for People of African Descent.
I know. And there were, I mean, it's great to have these declarations. However, throughout the country, that particular date wasn't even lifted up so people didn't know about it. And each city didn't do anything special.
Right.
That was a really important year. Mm-hmm.
Right. And see, even when we brought it to, you know, the attention of, you know, like, well, you know, your cities, the counties, the, you know, you can make a proclamation, you can recognize this.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Bobby Rush, you know, proposed some legislation that sort of went nowhere, never even got out of committee. But then, you know, I talked to a couple of Black Caucus members who didn't even know. I said, well, for God's sake, you're in the Black Caucus, in the Congress with Bobby Rush, and you don't even know. So we have work to do, you know.
Mhm. Yeah. And give me the last one again. I've got August 23rd. What was the last one again?
Oh, December 2nd.
December 2nd.
Is the International Day for the Abolition of Slavery.
Okay. Yeah. I remember Alan Laird introduced me to the community, and I was going to speak to the sister who was like sort of, you know, sort of doing a whole lot of work, she and her sons.
Right.
Yeah. Call her name for me because I haven't talked to her in a long time.
Yeah. Sister Altene.
Yes, it's Altene. Yeah.
Our best people on the planet. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's really amazing because a lot of you all who are doing this organizing, you're artists, and I believe you and I had our first conversation around the Henrietta Marie, and I told you that I had seen the exhibit because it traveled, and it was in Watts, Los Angeles area, and I went, my mother told me about it, and because I'm in Northern California, and so we got that opportunity to go check it out, and I bought the book. My auntie, my mother's big sister, is named Henrietta, so I don't hardly ever hear any Henriettas. And there's a slave ship, the last one found and intact with stuff in it, you know, artifacts, you know, dishes and all kind of stuff, chains.
And it came
in, you know, in your region.
Right. Exactly. And that was like, 26 miles west of Key West.
Yep. Mhm. Yeah.
There's a the late breaking thing is the same folks, the Mel Fisher Maritime Museum in Key West, is those are the folks who discovered that wreck.
Mm-hmm.
They recently discovered one in the Bahamas, and that made the newspapers last week. There's a ship called the Peter Mowell. Most of the Africans actually survived and made it ashore and got rescued and have descendants in the Bahamas today.
Wow.
So that fascinating story that is just, you know, I think we're just starting to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So like the story of the Africans that so many of them died before they were repatriated to another place on the continent. Did these Africans, were they enslaved or were they free?
Apparently, these were similar to the ones who came into Key West, since the ship sank, wrecked, I guess is the right word.
Okay.
Before they could be taken to any market, and this was 1860, so it was long after the slavery was abolished in the British countries. So being in the Bahamas, they were free.
Okay.
And you see, this was one of the things, I think, what was the name of the ship? I think it was the Creole, I believe, was the name of the ship.
Oh.
It was a ship that was bound for New Orleans, got blown off course, ended up in the Bahamas, and once they hit British territory, it was like, well, folks, you're free. That's it. You know, that's a story that I'm thinking we'll be able to, you know, this last ship, maybe trace some descendants and you know, see what oral histories have been passed down to them and so forth. So that
nice.
Every little bit that connects us to that mm-hmm. story of the Middle Passage and gives it a human dimension where we realize that, you know, these are people. These weren't cargo. They weren't, you know, little, you know, dark spots on a diagram of how a slave ship was. You know, there were folks with names and families and,
yeah,
you know, dreams, aspirations, skills, knowledge, which, of course, is why it was a slave trade in the first place. I mean, if they were, you know, the dumb savages that the people claim they were, well, there would be no desire for them. But because these folks had nation-building skills and, you know, strength and resolve and all of that, that's what made them, you know, you could almost say victims of their own success, because that's what made them desirable. And that side of the story is the one that we really need to tell, you know, more and more, so that and that of course even includes, as you know, just eliminating the use of this word slaves, you know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when we see what that is, then it really becomes clear what, you know, the magnitude of this crime against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who these people were, what they brought here, what they passed down to us. You know, in the way of, you know, strength, ability, and knowledge, and you know, that in turn gives us some idea of what we need to give back to our communities and give back to honor them and pay forward to future generations. And
mm-hmm.
basically, you know, the way, the same kinds of principles that guided us back before all of that started, you know.
Right, right, certainly. I was wondering about, we've already spoken in the past about the museum,
yeah.
and when it opened, I remember, and you all have had visits from royalty from the continent, West Africa, and I was also, since there is a hurricane coming, what do you all do when that happens? Are you evacuating?
I actually live in Miami, and not in Key West, but I understand that. The latest I heard is that there are likely to be evacuation orders,
mm-hmm.
But likely to be doesn't mean that it'll actually happen. If it's a serious hurricane, people do evacuate. Although, you know, I can remember hearing from people in the Black community in Key West that, you know, no, we stay regardless. We
just, oh.
And mm-hmm. Oh, really? I mean, it's seriously rolling the dice, but you know, they say that's their decision. The museum in Key West, it's an interesting place because it really started out as, it's called the Mel Fisher Museum, and it's named after Mel Fisher, who was, I guess some people would call him a notorious treasure hunter. I mean, you know, he's the whole stereotype people have of these people who just go and find wrecks and plunder and, yeah, you know. He, in some respects, fit that profile, but it's interesting that it was in his quest to find this Spanish galleon that was loaded with gold and silver and emeralds and all that stuff that they stumbled across the wreck of the Henrietta Marie. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that the Henrietta Marie story and the other stories in Key West related to slave ships, in fact, the museum now actually has an exhibit up called The Last Slave Ships, mm-hmm. has been given the museum a whole different meaning. And so much so that, you know, I would never have expected this, but as we speak, I'm actually on the board of the museum now. So just to show you. And we had one of the traditional kings from Ghana came 3 years ago when he came to Miami, when he and found out about the African cemetery in Key West. He wanted to go and do a reconciliation ceremony there, which he did, gave an eloquent speech, and he's been here in the 2 years since, and I think on both times, I mean, the second that he said to me after hello was, when do we go to Key West? And he's gotten to visit the museum down there, and he's been to the cemetery, and, you know, the last time he did a you know, just a beautiful, you know, healing ceremony. And so it's and of course, the fact that he's from Ghana, and his traditional area is right, is called La, L-A. And it actually includes the national capital of Accra. So it's, you know, it's interesting that Ghana has been sort of taking the lead in reaching back across the ocean and, you know, addressing the, you know, scattered, you know, descendants and so on. I mean, some of that is just craft tourism, which that's going to happen anyway. But there's also, I think, a very, you know, a genuine, you know, initiative there. So his being a part of that, I think, is all part of, you know, getting the circle to be unbroken and reestablishing these bonds and connections and so forth. And it's very positive to be, you know, part of this. And that's why, you know, we like when these international days come up, it's just a timely occasion to call attention to sites like that cemetery where, you know, I mean, here you're talking about something that's not abstract. This is like, you know, actual Africans are buried in the soil there, you know. And had been ignored. I mean, you know, a road goes through there, cars are driving, people are going to the beach, you know, who knew? So, you know, part of our effort now is I've been privileged to do quite a bit of the artwork on the memorial monument that's there, and we're wanting to add to that because we're really thinking that that memorial should be something very prominent, you know, commensurate with this magnitude of the story. And we've been able to do ground penetrating radar surveys and find where more of the burials are, you know, because it was, you know, people were using it as a dog park and all this kind of thing. So that we expect that cemetery to become more and more of a recognized landmark. I think it really has the potential to be a UNESCO World Heritage Site, you know, because it is so unique, you know, and it would connect to other places like that, like in Sierra Leone, and recently they found a cemetery on St. Helena Island, which is isolated way out in the South Atlantic, where people who were liberated from slave ships and, you know, who died on the island are buried. So there'll be, you know, all that kind of connection to be made with, you know, other places where ancestors suffered a similar fate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's always really wonderful to talk to you, Brother Dean.
Likewise.
Yeah, and so they want to have you on again to check in and see how things are going down in southern Florida region, Key West and Miami. See if you all sort of weather the storm if it actually hits, and because this is that time of year, and the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina is coming up, you know, next week on Wednesday the 29th. So, yeah, it's that time where the ancestors, you know, sort of let us know that you're still calling us back.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, I'll just share this about Katrina, you know, like, you know, that evening of the 28th, the 29th, you know, the 28th, that was the date of Barack Obama's acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention. It was the same date as the I Have a Dream speech in Washington, and it was the same date as the murder of Emmett Till.
Really?
In Mississippi.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. Yeah. It was intentional. That's why he gave it on that day.
Yeah. Okay, right. And so 50 years to the day after Emmett Till.
I'm talking about Martin King. You know, that's why he gave the IMG on that day. Yeah.
So,
You are such a great connect the dot person.
Well, we learn how to do that, you know, and then we and you know where we come from. That's what we do, you know. We know that all the dots are already connected. We just have to wake up and see them, you know.
Yeah. They've been covered in invisible ink, so you just got to shine some light on them, huh?
You know. Yeah.
Oh wow.
But, you know.
Yeah.
But
cool.
Well, listen. It's always an honor, a pleasure, and a privilege to be on. What we may do in Key West is, since we didn't do it for this International Day, we might do something on December 2nd. And that would be kind of appropriate, because then we can kind of, you know, forecast Kwanzaa and highlight the seven principles and, you know, do that kind of thing.
Right. Well, cool.
But you know, I'll be keeping you apprised of all good things happening down here.
Oh, yes, yeah, certainly. And send me some information about the latest finding of the ship.
I certainly will. There was an article in the Nassau Bahamas newspaper, and I'll forward that to you.
Okay, super. Thank you so much, and stay safe. We'll be praying for you all.
Thank you so much.
All right, you take good care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Peace and blessings.
Likewise.
So that was one of our scholars, that's Dini Zulu, Gene Tini, and he's in the southern part of Florida. And I'm going to close with this interview that I've been telling you about, and I know folks are probably like, when is she going to play it? So anyway, she's going to play it in a minute. But there's a great film. It's called Super Capitalist, and it's a financial thriller. And it's opening today, to this evening, or maybe this afternoon, but this evening, that's when writer and producer and actor Derek Ting and other members of the cast and crew are going to make appearances and speak at select opening weekend shows. And one of those places is Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, and that's going to really be fun. So I am going to play that interview for you, and it's going to go a little bit past the closing half an hour that we have here, so you can catch it all in the archives. But it's really fascinating, you know, all this information about, you know, the what's going on Wall Street and the connection to Hong Kong. And it's really, really, really quite interesting. And there's a love story and a lot of other, you know, sort of subplots. So, so we're going to play that. And I just, just got booted out of my studio. Oh, this is one of those days where it's like, oh, my goodness. Oh, here we are. Okay, so here we go. Super Capitalist. I enjoyed your film, even though I wasn't quite up on all of the financial details. Yeah, it was a really wonderful mystery, and I was wondering when I read sort of the preview information when it says thriller, and I'm like, thriller? It's about money. How could it be a thriller? But I sort of certainly understand how it could be that. And I was wondering when I was reading your bio on your wonderful website, randomartworkshop.com, and about your magazine and about your scholarship, you know, graduating from college, Cornell University in New York, where you were practical and studied statistics, and during your senior year, you went out of your way to take theater at Cornell's renowned drama school, and then after college in New York City, you balanced work and consulting with your passion, and you studied acting at T. Schreiber?
Yeah, Terry Schreiber Studio.
I don't know T. Schreiber. Is he famous?
Claim to fame is Ed Norton studied there. So I learned a lot of scene study. I also took classes at like NYU and the city, really, really part-timing it, trying to add to my craft. And then I'll study with Peter Miner, who's really a great director as well. He teaches at Columbia and is affiliated with Terry Travis Studios.
Okay, okay. Yeah, and you did a lot of work in national commercials, and you write in your bio that your strong desire was to understand the process that led you to produce several short films, but this film is your feature, your latest feature narrative. Is this your first feature or not?
Yeah, this is my first feature film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just amazed here. It's taken me 6 years to get it out from an idea, writing the script, and then raising the money, casting, and going into production, and then post-production, and then distribution. So definitely seen it end-to-end.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. And the film was shot in Hong Kong, right, where you live now?
Yes, for the most part it was. It was 20 days in Hong Kong. We did 2 days in Macau and 6 days in New York. We actually started shooting first in the New York scenes first.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. Yeah, yeah. And you write that you moved to Hong Kong to see more of the world and to visit your ginseng roots. and there you worked as a producer for CNN. You were writing, directing, editing promos for the prestigious station and continuing to strengthen your abilities. So that was a really great training ground, huh?
Yeah, I mean, my short film background and, you know, producing stuff in New York, experimentation and really just school hard knocks led me to CNN. And then it was really a sink or swim type thing. You know, if you were putting stuff out professionally and it's really, you know, placements in Time magazine or on TV, different areas, the creative aspect is, you know, it's really, I call it my, you know, face my film school, just by learning from all the other guys around me was fantastic. And out in Hong Kong, you know, it's a smaller crew, so you really have to work in the different areas, you know, whether it be producing, like producing and directing is almost the same title, which, you know, in the U.S. would be separated out. And then also, you know, it's just you have to edit your own stuff. And I think actually, though, that's definitely the way things are going. As technology gets more advanced and, you know, people are able to, you know, pick up different skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So when I was reading your bio and then, you know, reflecting on the film, it seems as if, I mean, the film is about a maverick New York hedge fund trader. You have to tell us what hedge fund, what that means. With an uncanny analytic abilities, he moves to Hong Kong and orchestrates a mega deal that swiftly escalates beyond his control. However, more than that, this particular film and you actually star in your own film, which is like, wow. I always find that it seems really difficult. Yeah. to
sell that to an investor. By the way, after you give me some cash to make this film, I want to star in it as well.
Yeah.
But honestly, it just made financial sense. I mean, you know, I accepted $0 for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And really in trying to, you know, find somebody for the film, I couldn't really, you know, it's really hard to find a lead actor which I could necessarily raise money off of.
Oh.
So I felt like, well, you know, as a, having a really small budget, at least I could be a part of that process and be in it. And then obviously my own passion and desires were, you know, it was great. But as a producer, you just have to be very, you know, you just have to feel and know if you can do it or not and you can achieve those goals. So I work closely with an acting coach. Her name is Jeannie Hartman. She's an L.A. acting coach to accomplish the task. And all the actors were very supportive and really, you know, helped me. And I learned so much along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Your character, Connor Lee, yeah, you have such a great cinematic presence. I mean, you know, really photogenic. And your surprise and disbelief and the pain that, because this film is, you know, it's about making money, but it's also about, you know, a young man, you know, sort of, at sort of, a critical point in his career, and you know, and the whole idea of not having his father in his life, you know, and he seems like there's a real big chasm there, you know, that he can't bridge because he doesn't have his father, and that might be one. That's one of the reasons why he's open to the offer to go to Hong Kong to work on this project. But it just seems like everyone is so unscrupulous. Oh my goodness.
I don't think everyone out there is, but you know, I think what we show in the film is that it's very easy to. I mean, there's temptation, and when you're presented with, you know, it's almost like getting a superpower. You know, that's why, you know, many meanings to supercapitalists. But imagine if you had a lot of money. I mean, think of the things you could do. You know, and would you use it for good or would you use it for evil? That's really, you know, really the challenge of this character. And hopefully people feel after watching the film. I really want to challenge myself as an actor. And, you know, Connor is not this underdog guy. He's actually just a regular guy that went through the ranks. He went to college, and, you know, he's not so, you know, underprivileged that he can't, you know, dig himself out of any hole. But, you know, I think he's, you find out, you know, why he's doing what he's doing. And, you know, when a normal person, which I think most of these people are, when normal people are placed under these circumstances, how do they react? How do they, you know, adapt? And, you know, balancing that with your own personal goals of success versus really taking a step back and looking at, you know, what's you know, who am I affecting? You know, what are my actions doing? Are they affecting other people? You know, do they have consequences? And then that was the fun part. And, you know, this character, you don't really find out, I think, until later on in the film, which is I found very challenging, is not to reveal what his true motivations are until the middle of the film. Almost like an anti-hero, which, which I really love doing. You know, like him enough. But I don't think you don't buy into the character as much. I think for most audience that we've talked to, you know, you like him enough and you want to follow what happens, and then you really find out who this person is.
So the whole idea of, you know, bringing in, you know, fathers and sons and the wonderful child that you have, you know, playing the son of, I'm not certain what the role is of the person who, Kathy Ewan, but her character Natalie introduces your character Connor to, and they go over, they have dinner, and I was wondering what is his role in the company that they're looking at making a hostile takeover of?
I mean, Mr. Chow, he's actually, you know, he's related to, you know, so to present these, you know, the big tycoons, in Hong Kong, you know, is very much like a family-run companies. That's really how they do it out there. It's not all, but it's very typical for a lot of the top companies. And, you know, Mr. Chow is this technologist, and he's related to them as a family member. And so he's developing a new system to optimize the shipping industry, which in Hong Kong is, you know, it was built off of trade. So you know, we're introduced to this character, and then really we just find out a little bit about a person working at a company in Hong Kong and what his family's like. And I think it's nice to see, like, so Connor, you know, Connor has these kind of skeletons in his closet, and we find out a little bit more about him through interacting with the son of this guy, and I think he learns a little bit more about himself too.
It's a multiple. He's has multiple layers, your character, which makes him interesting, and people always love a love interest with a conscience. So that's nice.
You know, I mean, it's funny because I really love the film because we really didn't try to, you know, categorized. And I know it's, I mean, it's a thriller. There's some there's structure to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to adhere to what a thriller does. But then,
hmm.
you know, we play with the love story. We play with you know, there's a lot of fun parts. Like there's some sarcasm and
mm-hmm.
sarcasm in the film, as you can see. You know, we're playing really as I think that's what movies are about, is to kind of to do that, just to have fun
mm-hmm.
telling a story. So, you know, all the choices about how the film would be presented,
mm-hmm.
you know, really tried to look at, you know, what type of movie did I want to see? And I think with our film, we really tried to, you know, I tried to go back to why I love film so much, and it's really just for pure enjoyment and to create a world and tell a story that I think is very real. Very possible, but also, you know, how we want to see ourselves as well, and how this character ends up.
Because
mm. There's many ways we could have gone with it, you know, especially you know with the financial thriller and the huge like cloud of the global financial crisis still like looming over us. You know, what did I want to see? You know, so hopefully people will watch the film and see for themselves.
yeah. So you mentioned that you know, sort of that the thriller, that's a genre. So what are the components of a thriller? And I was just thinking that the film, I don't know if thrillers have tragedy as well, because yours does. And I was thinking about the Occupy movement, but you know, how you set it up in the beginning with all these images, which kind of remind me of your website, you know, because of the way, you know, that's laid out. Is you know, the Random Art Workshop. You know how you open your film with all these different images that we're supposed to know, and some I do and some I didn't. People we're supposed to recognize, and some I did and some I didn't. And then you know, we get into the film. Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us about sort of the way it's set up, and perhaps tell us a bit about your cast, because it's great and it's huge.
I mean, you know, a thriller has, you know, in a thriller, someone's always got to die.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, that not necessarily has to happen, but it's, you know, it's a prime component. But, you know, a lot of it's about setup and then sort of keeping the pace
mm-hmm.
and following a through line. It's sort of, you know, really following the different kind of ups and downs of what the character, you know, a character can go through, and then going into the different acts. Like the third act, as you can see, picks up really fast. So
mm-hmm.
really playing with pacing, which was, I found, a challenge and something that I really learned from. And then, you know, in regards to the cast, I think what was really fun was that because, you know, we had such a small budget, and a lot of our investors just really gave us the free reins to, you know, choose people because they trusted us. They trusted us to make the best decisions about the cast. It was really just to look at the person and say, hey, like, you know, can this person do it? Do they have the potential? How much do they want it? Because,
mm-hmm.
in a Hollywood budget, you have those options where you can just pay somebody and you get the actor. In this case, you know, we'd really convey, hey, this is what we're trying to do, and then also to find out if that person can deliver for us. And I also feel, I guess, with the cast, we really got a chance to, you know, make something really diverse, which I think is, you know, not necessarily as common. You know, we got a chance to see, you know, how the Asian CEOs, how they manage their company, how they think, how they operate. But also even on the trading floor, if you look, I mean, I think it's also very diverse
mm-hmm.
versus some of the other movies that I've seen. You know, it's really very homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was really fun. I mean, it feels to me very real in the real world, but then when I think of how I grew up in media, I felt like it feels almost strange to me in a way.
Hmm.
not that there aren't films that are diverse, it's just there just aren't enough to really kind of show, you know, who's working in these offices, you know, what are they like?
Yeah, interesting. So you're saying that, I was going to ask you, were there any models or any films that you had in your mind that you were thinking of when the concept for this film came to you, like any films that it's like, okay, like this film is one of my favorite films.
Like Wall Street or something?
Yeah, exactly. Or even
yeah.
The Corporation, which is a documentary film based on a book.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, well, some of the stuff I've just, you know, now I've become kind of a student of you know, how companies operate and sort of and all those things, just to make sure that our film really represents and has a message that's realistic. We're not really trying to go too far, but you know, in the beginning, it started out like I wanted to make a movie in the finance world. You know, Wall Street was one of the first, but you know, as I went along, I really felt that we were kind of able to. You know, the movie started, shifting and shaping up. And what we found was that, you know, like, yeah, I have a lot of influence from, you know, Asian cinema, but I have a lot of influence from just movies I really like. I love Michael Clayton. It's what, you know, Tony Gilroy is amazing. I really tried to learn from him and what he's done. Obviously, Matt Damon, who wrote his own script, you know, looking at other movies, you know, anywhere from even like, I love Star Trek, you know, I love sci-fi too.
Mm-hmm.
So really just a compilation and a style that is fluid and not bound by, you know, the name and categorization that is really easy to, you know, it's really easy to fall into that just to get your movie made, just to get your movie sold.
Hello?
Yep, I'm still here.
Okay.
Yeah. It's at the Denny's.
Okay.
At the Denny's. On my way to San Francisco, everybody, August 24th.
Yeah.
Opened up at the Opera Plaza.
Super.
Who's
in the car with you? Who's going to be there with you this weekend?
We're really excited at Kathy Yuen, who's she's a top Vietnamese actress.
Mm-hmm.
She plays the lead actress. She's going to be there for the premiere in San Francisco, and then our Q&A's on Saturday as well.
Super.
Obviously, yours truly will be there, and producer Joyce Young, and that's it for San Francisco. Three of us will host.
Yeah, and then I thought I was reading that you're going to have another debut online or something like that. Is that true? Did I read correctly somewhere?
We're so fortunate to have a day and date distribution deal, which is which means that we're available on most cable VOD, you know, Time Warner, Comcast, all the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
We're on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the In Theaters Now section.
Nice.
Cinema Now, Vudu, all those, our distributor has been really awesome, and they really have supported our film. So we're there, and we open up in theaters across the country, and then we're opening up in L.A. August 31st. So it's a very new distribution model that I think the major indie films are getting, and we're very lucky to be pioneering this new way, because we think, you know, most people actually, when they hear about a film, they just want to see it.
Right.
And they want to consume it in different ways. So, you know, that's exciting for us, because we just think that, you know, hey, if you want to see the film, great. And however you want to see it, cool, here it is. And, you know, just come check us out and hopefully enjoy it. What's also exciting, we're the first to do what we're calling the Super Day and Date, which is we're available in iTunes across 14 territories across Asia, UK, and Scandinavia, which is really exciting for us. Up until last month, the iTunes stores in Asia were not available. so, but, you know, we talked to our distributors, hey, like, this just opened up. You know how Apple is, too. They're really secretive, right? They just let you know, right?
Right.
So once we heard, it was just like, oh, we want to be in there because that's revolutionary. I mean, that's a game changer for all filmmakers, which I think is just really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that we're in a new era of filmmaking with technology, with people's awareness, social media. It's a great time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. So who is the young man, the child that sort of really tugs at Connor Lee's heart?
Oh, who's that? His name is Brian.
Mm-hmm.
He's a young child in Hong Kong. He's older now. He went through this growth spurt. We saw him, and we're like, "You're so tall now." That's how long. Like that, you know, post-production was like 2 years.
Okay.
So, but we found him like our casting director in Hong Kong. She just really went. She does a lot of theater as well. That's how we really tried to find people in Hong Kong because there really is no formal process or there isn't as much. Isn't as easy, let's say, as Hollywood to find actors. So we went to people who were performing and really just loved it. And we found him. He had done a couple plays, and he was just amazing. I think he has more Facebook friends than I do.
So, oh, that's great. Yeah, he was really good.
He was so good. And, you know, I mean, the moments we had, I mean, a lot of them were so real because he's just such a good kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and his parents were so supportive. They brought him to set, and you know, every day, and just really, he had such, you know, we all had such a great time working together.
Nice. So, how close is this story to your life?
Oh, people always wonder. My parents, you know, they're still alive and kicking. Thank goodness. So for me to really, you know, I found it very challenging to find this character. You know, what would it be like to not have a father?
Mm-hmm.
I almost can't imagine it, really, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and, you know, I really had to just dig deep and write a lot of notes and work with people that would, you know, understand this character fully. And, you know, hopefully people feel it's believable. You know, we just had a word of mouth screening in L.A., which this guy came up to me and said, you know, my character was really, really believable, which was, you know, very heartwarming to me because at the end of the day, you know, that's what it's all for.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not for the money. It's just for, telling a story. And then if that story engages people and creates a discussion, that's even more exciting.
Right, certainly. Yeah, so your mother and father, you grew up in New York, or?
Yeah, I grew up in New York, born and bred. Really, I just grew up in a small suburb town.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Cornell, studied statistics, as you said, and then I lived in New York for most of my life until I moved to Hong Kong 7 years ago.
Okay.
In Hong Kong, I didn't know anybody.
Oh, okay.
I had no connections, really, and somehow, I mean, kind of that, in that respect, you know, I really maneuvering around Hong Kong and developing friendships, guanxi, you know, as we call it in the film, which means relationships in Mandarin, and guanhai for Cantonese. You know, finding support to make this film. And some of the people that I've worked with on this film have become, like, some of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, really see how, because the movie is really hard to, honestly, movies are really hard to make. I have definitely had those days where just like, you know, I can't do this anymore because it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very, you know, tough road.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really, and it's been a journey where we found like just new friends and fans who just kind of come and said, "Hey, I really get what you're doing. I want to help. How can I help?" And that's a really enlightening for me. You know, it's something where I'm just kind of like, wow, there really are good people out there. And that's the credits. The credits, as you watch the credits, they're so long that the music ends.
Yeah, I did watch the credits.
It's really funny. I almost feel like there's people I have, you know, I was really hard to, like, even when we were doing that, I was like, oh, really, I hope I didn't leave somebody off, and I made it. I'm really sorry about it, because, you know, I spent so much time checking every single name, mm-hmm. if you spelled correctly, all those things. But it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. It's even really difficult to do that, because you have to, you know, check with people. Hey, is this how you spell your name? You know, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
People know, like, even those little tiny things, you know, you have to really go through those details to make sure that you're also giving back to people who, like, lend their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you said you had no connections to anyone in Hong Kong. So your whole family, when they immigrated, your whole family immigrated to the United States?
The thing is, they're from the Philippines, actually.
Oh, okay.
The Filipino Chinese, so.
Oh, okay. You're biracial. Okay.
No, I'm Chinese, but my parents are from China.
Mm-hmm.
They're both, they moved to, our grandparents moved to the Philippines.
Mm.
So my parents were, you know, grew up there, and then they moved to the U.S. around the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean. Like, I didn't really know anybody in Hong Kong, but it's been an amazing experience. I think that's it's really a place I think is the center of there's competition between the cities in Asia. I think Hong Kong is the place just because it's so international. Like,
mm-hmm.
You meet so many different people from different countries, and I feel like I've learned a lot from just, you know, living there and exploring.
Mm-hmm.
Exploring all the different countries and just really seeing how much there is. It's almost, I mean, like, I really encourage people to go out there and, you know, check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you can learn a lot from there, going there and bring it back here.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the other way around, right? A lot of times, I think people about, you know, come here to the U.S., learn a lot, and then go back. I think that there's a shift. There's definitely a shift. I don't know where exactly, but, you know, we have to really recognize how, big and vast Asia is, and how fast they're rising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was just thinking about. I was thinking about how China owns United States debt, and then I was thinking about the Occupy movement and how current your film is thematically.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the script 1 year before the global financial crisis, so I had no idea what all these scandals that would happen, all these how people are very unhappy with the way things are being done right now. Occupy Wall Street is really, it's a symptom of a larger problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that needs to be addressed. I mean, clearly people are upset, and they have good reason to it.
Mm-hmm.
I can only think how relevant our movie is. Also, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people in the U.S. know about it, but there was a huge brother scandal, a tycoon scandal, called Hong Kong Gay, which happened 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the stuff that, I was writing about 6 years ago has really come to fruition by, no crystal ball or anything, but just kind of looking and doing research and just, making guesses, and also, making a movie that, I wanted to make a movie that was interesting, and, it's dramatic, so it's not, please don't take it like that, this is exactly how it is, but it's representative, I think, of, what the time is like, how are we thinking, how are we spending our money, and why are we doing things
mm-hmm.
the way we're doing them. It's really just to open the discussion, it's nothing else, it's not for you just say to go do this, go do that. Just open discussion, because that's what we need to do, is just talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely is a conversation starter on a lot of things, like you mentioned, you know, greed, consumption and overconsumption, you know, the way certain people are discounted because of where they are in the social hierarchy. And then also sort of the egotism that many Americans carry with them on purpose and by accident, or not actually not accident, but people don't think about their privilege. And then sometimes they do. You've got characters like Mark Patterson, you know, Linus plays him really well. Linus Roach, he plays him really well. And it's like, wow, he just, he is so yucky. And then all the other folks that happen to surround, a lot of the other folks, Americans that surround, you know, Connor Lee. But the folks that are really unscrupulous, like the evil or the villains, are not only Americans. We just happen to have more Americans that are villains than others.
I mean, like Linus' role, I was really, by the way, Linus is just an amazing person to work with in general. I mean, just his morals and principles and how he does business, it's just, it, you know, he literally, you know, supported, you know, he's one of the very first supporters of our film. And he, you know, he's been so committed to just continuing to support us. So, but he, what I really liked about him is he, you know, he asked for certain things if he wanted to present this character, Mark Patterson, who, you know, it's very easy to go to a caricature. But, you know, he said, you know, we wanted to place him in situations. You may not notice it. We place him in situations, you know, just to kind of give you a window of what type of person he was. You know, we see his family, and then we see how he's, you know, how he is when he's traveling. And you see how he interacts with his daughter. Very quick glimpses, but I think they really speak to, like, this type of person. And one of the things he asked for was, you know, he said, oh, I want, because, you know, Jim was an article about some of these, you know, big hedge fund trader guys. And there's one guy named Dan Loeb, and he said, Dan Loeb does yoga. I want to do yoga in the film. So he asked to put it in the film. And then he said, I really wanted to show, like, how, you know, because yoga is a very spiritual thing. And then, you know, the duality of this guy being so materialistic and really just after, you know, just being greedy and spiritual at the same time. He's really this, you know, two-sided person, and you really get that flavor for him. So, I mean, I really enjoy his point. All of them, though, you know, all these heavyweights have really come in just to support our film, and we really like the script. So, and they brought so much. I learned so much from them. It's like, I lived my dream. I've really lived my dream. You know, honestly, whatever happens from the film, you know, great. But you know, I already lived it because I got to work opposite people in the industry who I respect. You know, 200% as people and as professionals.
And would you make another film? Or are you making another film?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's exciting is that I think, you know, we've gotten really good traction. You know, the dream was always to, yes, make one film, but then really build from there and really to make films where, that you know, it's really supporting artists. You mentioned Random Art Workshop. I mean, that's one of the missions that we had 3 years ago. In Hong Kong, we wanted to build an art community. So we're all about developing new talent. And, you know, finding their potentials and developing them and really giving them a shot. And I think that's you know, one of the higher principles of this film is that there's a lot of new people in it. You know, we found them. We really searched for, you know, good people to work on the project. And, you know, it's about building something, which I think people, you know, people a lot of times look at the short term. That's, you know, it's very easy to do in capitalism, for sure. Looking at the long term and saying, hey, maybe from this point, these people can go on to make another film or, you know, work and get better and better. It's really about opening those channels for those people and then seeing them succeed as well. So That's exciting.
Yeah, because I just like your mission statement for your Random Art Workshop. You know, many people come to Hong Kong to make their money and leave, but the two of you, you and your partner, what's your partner's name?
Joyce Young.
Yeah, Joyce Young. Wanted to and still feel that Hong Kong deserves more permanence, especially in the field of art. So, and you write that we also felt that being an accountant, lawyer, and banker, et cetera, does not preclude you from being an artist nor make you any less creative. And I like sort of like the line that a safe haven to try that Random Art Workshop or RAW is a safe haven to try new things without judgment because all art is created equal. Really nice. Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you have these magazines that you've been publishing since last, what, December?
Yeah, we just started that. Like, we're on our fourth issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really very excited about that. And that. You know, most of that is just all Joyce. You know, I can't really take as much credit for it. But she's been my partner, my business strategist on this film.
Mm-hmm.
All the hard decisions, we've talked about them to death, just to know what's the best way to move forward. That was something we found, in Hong Kong, and I think just as a very universal thing that we're not. There's other ways to kind of to do things. You know, there's more to life than just going out, and not that there's anything wrong with it. I'm just any person who wants to go out and have a drink sometimes, or go to a club and listen to music and dance. But
mm-hmm.
there's other things where you can explore. And also, it goes back to the movies, overall thesis of perception. Just because a person's wearing a suit doesn't mean that they're not creative. I think a lot of people think that, which is totally not true. You know, it's just some people feel like, oh, if I can't draw, I'm not creative. And that's a very easy statement to make, and that's a very easy assumption to make, but it's not true. And so creativity is really healthy. It's healthy for our happiness. It's healthy for, talking about something and talking with your friends and taking another step in a different direction.
Mhm. Yeah, because it's all about, finding community, because you go to a club and, if you go alone, even if you meet someone, you're still kind of isolated, but if you are part of a community and you're developing relationships, then that's more long-term than just the one-night, stand, so to speak, and that sort of comes into play when we think about your character, Connor Lee. He's been feeling like sort of out of the loop because even when we meet him in New York, he's kind of isolated. He lives alone. He's real brilliant with numbers, and that's what he does for fun. And he sits in his cubicle, and he does what he does, and everybody knows he's really smart. And no one's thinking like he's thinking, so he's just really isolated. He needs, a random art with it, random art movement.
I think that it's very easy as for anybody as a professional to get caught up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just very true. Everybody is very universal, gets caught up in their jobs,
mm-hmm.
and you can forget about, wait a minute, what about my Friday night? Like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And what is it going to be? And people need different outlets.
Yeah.
There aren't enough outlets where I think really force us to think or force us to learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely what we've tried to build out there and develop, because it's important, that's what makes us, whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm thinking, I want to let you go because we've been having this great conversation, but I want to let you, I don't know if you finished your Denny's or not, but but we want you to get here, for the show, and we want you to have time to rest up. I was wondering, I think I was listening to NPR, and there was some kind of evaluation of the working conditions of for Nike, I think. No, it was Apple, one of the two. And it was, they were looking at China and sort of the employee working conditions. Was that, did you hear that? And they were actually, they have this organization that sort of evaluates the working conditions for employees, and then they give the corporation sort of an evaluation, and then the corporation is supposed to, you know, address these issues, and actually they were addressing them to try to make things better for the employees. Did you hear that report?
I didn't hear that report, no. But you know, I think in general, you know, we have to really look at, you know, what's going on out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the clothes we wear, the devices that we buy, there a lot of them are being made out there.
Mm-hmm,
So, and you know, these guys are working really hard. I've been to factories before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we complain a lot here in the U.S. about conditions, but I think, you know, how many hours they work. I think those guys work a lot of hours, and the pay that they make is really,
mm-hmm.
it's really minimal, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we really have to kind of just take a look at, you know, all these things that we aspire to get and, like, what's it worth.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it, how is it affecting us? How is it affecting the world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would even say, like, you know, even here, like, should we buy American? I think we should. I think we should look at, like, opening up jobs and here, even if it costs more,
mm-hmm.
I think it's worth it. It's
yeah.
really worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, looking at how they operate, I think, you know, there's a lot to learn. I think while, you know, Asia's on the rise, they're still learning and they're still adapting. And they're trying to do their best, honestly, to just have a, you know, what we all want is stability on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we want. So everyone can secure their lives. We really have to take a look at that and just make sure we're doing that and not really, you know, falling into these pitfalls. Because it's very easy to say, hey, I could make a lot of money doing what I'm doing. It's very easy to get away with it
mm-hmm.
on either side of the world. Yeah, this is universal. It's not just Asia. It's not just the U.S. It's just universal to get away with it. So let's be careful about that. Let's keep an eye out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, congratulations on your first feature, and wow, it's, the marketing methodology is really, really quite innovative, and so a lot of people are going to be watching your film. So how is it being received in Hong Kong?
Oh, Hong Kong was amazing. We actually had, you know, we didn't know how to launch this because, you know, it's an official, like, indie film born out of Hong Kong, English
mm-hmm.
language.
Yeah.
And you know, we got the U.S. deal here in April, and it's just been go, go, go. And one of the decisions was like, oh, well, you know, do we launch like the press first in Hong Kong? And what I thought about it was like, yeah, we should, because that's where it all started. So and they were really supportive. They were really. They wrote about us right away, like the stories came out. So, you know, really appreciate all the goodness that these guys, you know, support. Tony Lowe from CNBC, he's my first TV interview.
Mm.
Apple Daily, Sunbo, which is like a Hong Kong Economic Journal, South China Morning Post was our first written. And we, you know, we've gotten full page spreads in a lot of publications, both in English and in Chinese, which is exciting for us. You know, we're really glad. You know, like I said, at the end of the day, I was just trying to make a movie, honestly, and just trying to keep it real, you know,
mm-hmm.
And have fun with it. But I didn't really know that, what we're doing was, you know, really starting a movement, I think,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, for us, it's kind of cool, you know, if you know, just a simple, just a knowledge, you know, just a simple idea, just a simple thing can really change people in a good way, in a positive way.
Right.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
so thank you very much for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for such an extended conversation. I really appreciate that. It was great talking to, you know, the... so you aren't the director, but, you know, this is your story, and you're the star, well, one of the stars, but you're, like, the, you know, protagonist. So it's really great just sort of finding out more about, you know, how this film came to be and about the character and about, you know, Hong Kong, you know, its setting.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. And really it's been about many people
mm-hmm.
putting in the time, and I appreciate you putting in the time. So thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome. And have a fun time and opening weekend in San Francisco at the Landmark Mark Cinemas at Opera Plaza.
I will.
Yes.
I will. Opera Plaza, August 24th, San
mm-hmm.
Francisco. Here we come.
All right. You take good care.
Thank you very much, Wanda.
Okay. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
So we were speaking to Derek Ting, who is not the director of Super Capitalist, rather he is the writer and producer. And again, he plays the protagonist, sort of the star of the film. And he and member of the cast and the producer, Ms. Young, are going to be at the screening at Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco this evening, August 24th. And I don't know how much, if they're going to be hanging out over the weekend. I don't know if they're going to be around on Saturday and Sunday, but definitely tonight, Friday night, they're going to be around. And as for Rhonda Spalding, is going to be performing at the Paramount Theater in Oakland tomorrow, Saturday, and there is a 40th anniversary jazz festival that Yoshi's is throwing in Jack London Square. So that's going to be fun for the whole family on Sunday. What else is going on? Let's see. I wanted to let you know about this wonderful film. It's called Hermano, and it's also opening tonight. This one's opening in San Francisco as well at AMC Metreon. And it is, oh my goodness, it is such a great film. It first premiered. The film is called Hermano, and it's directed by Marcel Ruskin, and it premiered at the Moscow Film Festival, where it won the top prize in Best for Best Film. It also received the top prize for Best Narrative Feature at the Naples Film Festival, the Audience Award at the Los Angeles Latino Film Festival, and a special jury mention for the first film at the Havana Film Festival. So that's really prestigious. The Havana Film Festival is well-renowned. Shot in Venezuela, Hermano, directed by Marcel Ruskin, is a powerful film where relationships or blood ties do not dictate who one calls brother or hermano. Brothers are bound by love, bound by work, and bound by necessity in this film or within this story. In the close-knit community where the brothers Daniel and Julio live, the slums of La Cineza, football is the most positive communication for the two brothers and the larger brotherhood or team. The boys worship the Caracas football team, and when we come into the story, the two young men are Daniel, he's younger, and he's an exceptional striker, a phenomenon. And Julio, his big brother, is the captain of the team, and he's a natural leader. And they both play soccer in the slum. And so when we enter the story, there's a headhunter that arrives that's recruiting for the Caracas football club, and he invites them to try out for the team. Some other stuff intervenes. So Hermano, the film, resonates with biblical fervor. What happens when Cain slew Abel or Joseph's brother tossed him into a well? Certainly such actions were antithetical to a Partridge Family reunion. But in Ruskin's film, the lines or boundaries that hold the brothers bleed into other spaces, some irreversible. The world Hermano reveals is tough, pain inevitable and almost expected. Soccer is an escape for the men. For the boys. It is the window between the two brothers. It is where words are unnecessary. It is how the two men say, I love you.
Their mother bakes cakes, Julio runs drugs, and Daniel goes to school. Daniel loves his mother, worships his brother who saved his life on the elder Julio's sixth birthday, maybe fourth birthday or third birthday. Anyway, he was really young. And then Julio takes his gift back, his gift of life back, his gift of love back. Filled with suspense, great characters, especially first-time acting debuts by Elia Armas, Julio, and who plays Julio, and Fernando Morena, who plays Daniel, and the supportive cast, including the coach, actors who play the coach, the mom, the girl Daniel loves who belongs to someone else, the street children, and the gang leader. So I highly recommend this film, which also opens, as I mentioned, tonight or this afternoon or this morning or today. And you can visit musicboxfilms.com/Romano to read more about it. And, again, it's a fabulous film. And Super Capitalist is also opening today at the Landmark Theaters at the Opera Center Plaza in San Francisco. And, again, the director and one of the members of the cast, like the leading lady, the love interest, and the producer, they're all going to be in town to talk about this film, which is certainly thought-provoking, a financial thriller. It's named. So we're going to go out with one of Donald Doug Bailey's pieces. I'm going to play the one Blues It, which I really like. Take good care and look forward to have you tune in for another edition of Wanda's Picks on our Hurricane Katrina anniversary special, Wednesday, August 29th. Peace and blessings.